Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Several reports have come out in the last year about the massive disparity between mortality rates for white and black mothers and babies. The statistics are truly staggering. Black mothers are 3 to 4 times more likely to die during pregnancy and childbirth than white mothers, and black infants in America are now more than twice as likely to die as white infants. These reports have been shocking not only for the racial disparities they reveal, but also because of the apparent lack of reaction on the part of the medical industry, despite the fact that these disparities have existed and indeed gotten worse for years. A recent episode of WNYC's The Stakes, a new podcast, which is hosted by my colleague Kai Wright, recounts personal narratives of black women dealing with the healthcare system. And it also takes a close look at what roles institutional racism and implicit bias play in how medical practitioners actually treat black women. The episode is titled Giving Birth While Black, and it was produced by WNYC's Verilyn Williams. Hi, Verilyn.
Hi.
She joins me now in studio along with Linda Villarosa, a former executive editor of Essence, who has also been a contributing reporter and editor at the New York Times. She published an investigation last year in the Times titled Why America's Black Mothers and Babies Are in a Life or Death Crisis. Linda, welcome to the studio as well.
Thank you.
So on May 7th, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released its own statistics about black maternal and infant mortality rates. Verilyn, what did the CDC say?
Well, I mean, these are numbers that are pretty new. Before it was dealing with up until 2005. I'm looking at Linda because she's been my go-to. Every time I get into a reporting challenge, I'm like, Linda, what? So she's literally the expert on this. And so right now, it's black women are 3.3 times more likely to die than white women, which is down 0.2%, give or take.
Yeah. I think what's interesting, too, is we look at death, but near death is also really important. And
yeah, oh yeah.
For every woman who dies, 100 women almost die.
Mm-hmm.
And what about the infant mortality rates? How are they connected to the maternal mortality rates?
So how I think of it is it's all one person's body. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people separate that or say that the high maternal mortality rate is because of a hyper focus on the infant. I don't agree with that. I think it's more complicated. And especially when you look at the black population, we have both problems. Maternal mortality is higher. Infant mortality is higher. It's one woman's body. So there has to be a connection just logically.
Mm. At what point did this start to get on people's radar? I feel like it's recent.
Well, no, I mean, I've been hearing, I used to work next to an organization, Ancient Song Doula Services, and I heard women talking about this for years. And then
I should say that in the mainstream.
Yes.
Let me put that.
Yes.
Let me qualify.
Yeah. Yeah. But so then there are these waves where people are talking about it, then it dies down, then this elected official talks about it, then it dies down. You know, all that reporting by NPR a few years ago, then Linda put out like what I think of as like the manifesto, like pulling together all these different waves. And so now we're in this moment where like, okay, more it's on more people's consciousness. But one of the things I was really interested in is like, well, I'm a black woman. We're three black women sitting in this studio. What do we do with this information? Because it's not like black women are like not having babies, right? And so what do we do when we know that we're much more likely to die? And if you don't have that awareness, how do you navigate some of the causes, which, you know, racism?
I'm interested about the CDC numbers. Is this true that they are the only up-to-date statistics about this issue?
Not the only, but it's the definitive. So this is our government counting based on state numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And not every state has a maternal mortality review committee. And that is a group in the mm-hmm. state that looks at every death certificate for a mother who dies either in pregnancy or in childbirth or in the year after she's had a baby. And so it's really important to have the correct statistics. But if we don't, not every state has it, then you can't have these more sophisticated statistics. But this is much better than it was.
What is the impact, either in terms of policy or politically, of these statistics? I have to imagine it's important to have these statistics to make the needle move.
One of the most important pieces of legislation happened last year, and it was to make these statistics better. And
oh,
so it happened in December 2018, and it was the Preventing Maternal Death Bill. legislation. And it was really important to say, we're going to put money toward this, because before there wasn't a lot of money toward even making the numbers right and correct counting. So that was really important. And then Farrell and I were looking at some of the other pieces of legislation and discussing them, bouncing them back and forth.
No, yeah. And but to that point, one of the things I think, because I, for the most part, had done a lot of like personal narrative reporting. And so once you start looking at numbers, you know, it feels like, oh, I'm doing this like great statistical work. And I was surprised by the lack of numbers, you know, like, and then the gap of it, like the four, like right now we're 4 years behind. I mean, we're excited that we have this new CDC numbers, but it only goes up until 2015. And so for me, that's been really like how is it that the reporting, I mean, they are collecting this data, but no one is looking at it. A lot of candidates running right now has put out a plan. And we talked about Cory Booker's plan, which really deals with the Medicaid. But Kamala Harris, I think, really talks about the implicit bias piece, like dedicating funding to make sure that hospitals are really training their doctors, and not just their doctors, but going into the medical schools as well.
And we were also looking at Cory Booker's legislation, because his is expanding Medicaid for the first year after the baby is born. And most women die after the baby is born, in the year after. So it's really important that they have medical coverage. And then the other thing it does is it expands Medicaid coverage to doulas and to midwives.
My guests are Vera Lynn Williams and Linda Villarosa. We're talking about Black maternal mortality rates. So Vera Lynn, why did you want to do this episode? What was the genesis of this?
So, again, I mean, I'm almost 18. As I say in the piece, I'm 18 months away from being 35, which is the when you become a geriatric
I know it all
pregnant
too well.
Person.
I had my son at 42, advanced maternal age. You hear it every week.
Hate that.
And then also, you know, I feel like my sister has my niece, and obviously my mom has given birth to three children, me included. And so I just realized that even though I knew all these women that have babies that have been pregnant, I didn't really know their birth story. I didn't know like what it actually took. And I think, you know, there's this consciousness that Black women have higher risk pregnancy. I know a lot of women that talk about having preeclampsia, but like as far as connecting the dots and really being able to think about, okay, well, what does that look like? Like, what does it look like to be more at high risk? And what does it look like for women in my family? I never really investigated that. And so I think like that was the genesis of me being like, well, if we're talking about the stakes, which is the name of the podcast, for me, these are very, very high stakes, right? I am of birth giving age. I'm Black, and Black women are a lot more likely to die. So it only felt like a very straightforward line to that.
As you started putting together the episode, who did you decide to interview? How did you decide who to interview?
Mm-hmm. So the first person I went to was my friend Leanne, who had just given birth to her second son. And when she told me she was pregnant, this is my woke pregnancy. And so she was, and she also like, she's been in, she's like in the Planned Parenthood world, like this like reproductive rights world. And so she was very aware of some of these numbers and everything that, you know, has come out with all of Linda's work. And so like talking to her, and it's really getting to understand, like, okay, so we're aware of this, but like also what happened to you during your first pregnancy. And then of course I also spoke to Chessie McMillan Cotton, who is a sociologist, and just like, you know, even in the personal essay world is to me one of the definitive voices. I mean, one of the things I think a lot about is just like how Black women are the experts on our own experiences. And so a lot of times when we are talking about what's the facts around these numbers, it's often because a Black woman has done the work. Yeah, okay, I see nodding, because sometimes I say things like that and it's something I feel, but it's also something I think has been proven out by my reporting. Like when you look at who are the experts around this stuff, so another thing I did was go to Woodhull Hospital, where they are, you know, implementing some of the New York City solutions, which is to fund simulations around what do you do when someone is in crisis. And, you know, it doesn't come out in the piece because it just would have been too much to unpack, but a lot of the women in that room were Black. Right. And so, I mean, not to say that, because obviously Leanne's first OBGYN was a Black woman. So, I mean, we're talking about institutions. So when we talk about implicit bias, it doesn't mean that like a Black woman the solution is just to put black faces, right? Implicit bias institutionally just means that the system is biased, and it's like institutional racism is in the fabric of it. But I do kind of see, like, when you talk about who is a part of the solution, I tend to see a lot of women of color in those rooms.
You interviewed Dr. Tressie McMillan Cotton, and she's a sociologist, as you mentioned, and she talked to you about how she struggled to be believed by her white doctor. Let's take a listen to a clip from your episode, which is from Dr. Tressie McMillan Cotton's audiobook.
That day, I sat in the waiting room for 30 minutes. After I had bled through the nice chair in the waiting room, I told my husband to ask them again if perhaps I could be moved to a more private area to wait. The nurse looked alarmed about the chair and eventually ushered me back.
When she finally did see a doctor, she was told she was spotting because she was too fat and that was normal. So she went home. But she was still in pain, her butt hurt, she wasn't able to sleep. And when she called her doctor's office and told them this,
the nurse said it was probably constipation. I should try to go to the bathroom. I tried that for all the next day and part of another. By the end of 3 days, my butt still hurt and I had not slept more than 15 minutes straight.
She went back to the hospital knowing something else had to be wrong. She writes that eventually they decided to do an ultrasound, and the image showed that there were two benign tumors growing fast alongside her baby. So no, it wasn't gas. And when Tressie gave birth to her daughter prematurely, 4 days too early for medical intervention, her daughter died shortly after her first breath.
That is from the episode Giving Birth While Black from the podcast The Stakes. It's produced by Vera Lynn Williams. Linda, you have this huge report. I encourage people to read it, from the New York Times, about this issue. And in your report, it was published last year, you recount a woman's named Simone's experience.
Simone Landrum.
Tell us a little bit about what happened during her third pregnancy.
So she had two children, and then she got pregnant again with a little girl. And so she noticed that her face was swelling. Through Instagram, she was looking at photos of herself on Instagram, and then she was having headaches. And so she reported her symptoms to the doctor, and he said, oh, if you're having headaches, take Tylenol. And then the headaches became worse, and so he said, take more Tylenol. And then she had near the end of her pregnancy, and her blood pressure spiked in the doctor's office. And he said, okay, calm down and sit down and calm down, and then your blood pressure will go down. And so when she was telling me this, both of our blood pressures were rising during that retelling of it. And I went back and looked at her medical records, and sure enough, there was a handwritten note about the blood pressure, but no one thought to say preeclampsia. So she ended up, she thought her water had broken, but it was blood on the seat of her car. She went to the hospital in an emergency situation. She was bleeding and almost died, and then her baby girl died. And so then when she got pregnant again the following year, she was terrified because she had been treated so badly, and her doctor really didn't pay attention to symptoms that at this point, you know, or you can look them up on the internet, and then, you know, didn't listen to her.
What went up about your reporter spidey sense? You're an editor, you're a longtime journalist. When you're hearing these stories, what are the questions you have as a journalist that need to be answered?
So the question is, why aren't doctors and other medical personnel listening to women who are reporting things, whether it's Serena Williams, it's Simone Landrum, whoever it is, what's going on? And when I ask experts, I interviewed a lot of people, 35 people, and what I listened to most was, do not necessarily blame individual providers, because, you know, the way this has been looked at in the past around infant mortality and maternal mortality is blame the woman. So now we can't just shift to saying, let's blame individual providers. It's to look at the system, to look at institutional racism, to look at racism in the healthcare system. And I used to say race in the health, and now I don't. I'm like, forget it. This is not about just because we're black, we have higher rates of this and that. It's like, because of the lived experience of being black people in this country and in our system, something bad is happening to us and our babies.
And can I, because I think for me, one of the reasons I don't always say racism, because I think when you say racism, particularly to white folks, is like this the end of the conversation, because like you can say I am not racist, so therefore you know, what are we talking about here? And so I've always hesitated, because I was just like, well, how do we get the other person to hear me? And you know, one of the other people I spoke to for my piece was Dr. Deborah Cohan, and you know what I appreciated so much about the article she wrote for the New England Journal was it, first of all, it was titled Racist Like Me, right? And so
let's get people caught up. She's a white doctor who wrote a piece about where she confronted her own
implicit bias. Yes. And hearing her say this, so it wasn't like we're starting from a different place, right? It's not explaining to her or like trying to get her to understand that where she jumped to wasn't like by happenstance, right? It came from somewhere.
Let's listen to Dr. Cohan from The Stakes. It's a really interesting clip. It's this doctor who is confronting her own bias. Take a listen.
She's white and wrote an article in the New England Journal of Medicine. It's called, you ready?
Okay.
Racist Like Me.
Okay.
And in it, she's examining her own implicit bias and how it affects the care that she's giving Black women.
And does she get specific? Does she have a specific case she talks about?
Well, when we spoke, she told me about a time a pregnant woman was brought into her hospital after having an encounter with the police.
So I was interacting with her, and it was just a flash of a moment that I saw in her a character from a movie I had seen. I noticed that. And then I invited myself, you know, I asked myself, okay, how is this influencing my behavior right now? And I realized that I was sitting further away from her than I usually do.
The movie was Sing. Do you know what that's about?
I do not know that movie.
It's a cartoon, and one of the characters is a gorilla.
Okay.
Who helps his dad commit robberies.
I'm not proud of how that movie got into me, but there are a gang of gorillas who are criminals that feeds into so many just horrific stereotypes of Black people and how they've been compared to animals and how the stereotype of them is so wrapped up with criminal justice.
So Cohan notices the association in the moment that she was making between this patient that was sitting in front of her and this character on the movie Sing. And she does move closer to her. But as she admits, the damage is already done.
That is from The Stakes, the podcast. The name of the episode is Giving Birth While Black. First of all, that's messed up because that's a kid's movie.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it many times. Mm-hmm. Let's start there.
And the character that plays the gorilla character is a British white guy.
Linda, what responsibility do medical schools have in this, with this issue?
So I think what's really interesting here is where we used to say, oh, Black people have higher levels of this, that, and the other because of race. It really is, so we were looking at race as, you know, a contributing factor, when it really is a marker for discrimination, inequality, and bias. And so that is something that I found medical students are really interested in. Their medical schools aren't quite as interested in that. And I was really excited, from a positive perspective, to see medical students pushing back against some of their education because they were politicized during Black Lives Matter. And I don't just mean Black medical students. And they were politicized and they were interested in confronting and tackling the bias that is in the system, talking about it first, tackling it, learning new ways to be doctors and more empathetic ways to be doctors and other medical providers. So I think schools have a responsibility to pay attention to their own students and what they want. And I think this is a really interesting way of looking at it because it's from the ground up as opposed to the top down.
Do you think narrative medicine, I know some medical schools are really engaged with that as a way to teach doctors to listen, to understand people's stories. It seems like this would be an area where narrative medicine could really make a difference.
Narrative medicine is wonderful. Some people call it empathetic medicine. But I think whatever it is, it's about listening, and it's about listening to the people that you're serving. Mm-hmm. And also, if you think of more of a service as opposed to, you know, you're the all-knowing, God-like doctor, it's a better way to be more engaged with your patients.
Yeah, and then that was another thing that I struggled with because I had experience, the piece I talk about, my own personal experiences dealing with doctors, right? And so there is this, like, what was termed like the medical hierarchy, where doctors are like at the top of the food chain and they get the final say. But at the end of the day, if I'm telling you what you know medically, scientifically, is not the sum of all that makes what's wrong, what's happening to me, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I share me trying to figure out a skin issue that I was having, and this doctor was trying to tell me that I had herpes. I, like, literally for, like, 4 years reported on sexual health, right? And so I'm like, I'm not, you know, I know what you're where you're coming from. I can see why you made that jump. That's not what this is, right? And so a doctor being able to hear them, being able to think about, okay, what does this person must know their body more than my scientific training. And so, yes, I do agree that it starts in the schools. I guess I just also, I mean, part of it can also be a part of, like, letting people, because there are people that will defer to the doctor, right? And so that's the thing that we have to kind of hold in hand. Like, you also are the expert in what's going on in your body on a certain level.
That's true. And it's about being proactive, but it's also about doctors and other medical providers be willing to listen to us, because we do know. And I think also part of the reason this issue of maternal mortality and infant mortality has come to the fore is because of the work of Black women. Mm-hmm. There's a group called Black Mamas Matter Alliance, who, that's how I heard about this issue. That's how many of us heard about it, because they put together a report, and that's someone that I knew said, have you read this? And I thought, oh. And I had a doctor a few days ago, a physician who's also a researcher, say, we've been knowing about this. And I did a medical report for a journal in 2010, but the media didn't pay attention. But I was like, huh, I paid attention when it was written in plain language, but all the research was there. It talked about activism, and it used the real voices of real people in this report, which was really good, made by Black women. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, I love when something comes to me that way.
Yes.
My guests are WNYC's Verilyn Williams. The name of her episode, which is part of the Stakes podcast, is Giving Birth While Black. Also talking to Linda Villarosa, who has written this great piece. Just go look at it, Why America's Black Mothers and Babies Are in a Life or Death Crisis. You answered this a little bit. The value of these narratives, the values of telling these stories, even though they might sound the same, to repeatedly tell these stories, what is that value? What difference can that make?
I think that it just shows, if you aren't going to read a medical journal, you can at least listen to the collective voices of Black women telling our stories, especially if we haven't been listened to. It's important for medical providers to hear that. This issue, we haven't even said this part, is it doesn't make a difference. It doesn't make a huge difference around class. So a Black woman with an advanced degree is more likely to almost die or have her baby die than a white woman with an eighth grade education. So I've heard people say it this way: we can't educate ourselves out of this problem. We can't doctor our way out of this problem. We can't, you know, income our way out of this problem. This is something that we really have to confront. But it really matters when we tell our stories.
And seeing it as a connective tissue, right? So, you know, oh, I know this happened to my aunt, and I know this happened to my friend next door. But I think the more, like, a Serena Williams and Beyonce comes out and shares their stories, like, oh, wow, like, if this could happen to Serena Williams, then let me advocate, let me push a little bit. And actually, I have two women in here that are moms. I am not a mom. I mean, like, does this resonate on a personal level for either of you?
Oh, yeah. No, my doctor, when I was giving birth to my son, he stayed too long and needed to come on out. And when I first went to the hospital, they almost gave me the wrong medicine. I'm glad I asked a lot of questions. And then I got upset because it was the wrong medicine, and I started to cry. She's like, why are you crying? And I said, because I want this to happen safely. And my doctor pulled me out of there. She said, go home. We're not having this baby today. I don't like the vibe in that hospital right now.
Wow. That's your OBGYN. Mm-hmm. Well, do you mind what's her race?
My doc is white.
The thing about bias is an implicit bias that you're not conscious of it, right? And so we need to figure out a shorthand to get to the fact that this is a problem.
In your podcast, you really highlight women taking control. Mm-hmm. in a way that they can take control of their situation. What are some of the ways that the women you talk to are taking control of their situation?
Yeah, well, Leanne, I mean, we haven't talked much about doulas, right? But Leanne, she was very much like, I want a midwife. I want to be in a birthing center. In her first pregnancy, she got an episiotomy, which if anyone doesn't know what episiotomy is
when, you go Google it.
Yeah, go Google it. without her consent, mm-hmm. you know, it just happened. And so she knew what she didn't want, and she got a doula that actually helped her implement all those things. And so, I mean, I want to say that it's still individual and case by case, because there's some women that would gladly go into a labor and delivery room and want all the medication. You know, mm-hmm. Leanne didn't want epidural. So it's still, I mean, the idea is that having the choice, you know, and having a say in what happened. So no one is telling you what's happened, but they feel obligated to talk to you about it and say, like, okay, we're going to do, like, her baby was her first pregnancy. Her son was taken away from her for 2 hours and she didn't know why. Right. Mm-hmm. So I can't imagine that. You just went through the most difficult thing your body will do ever. And then, you know, they'll take your baby and you don't know why. I mean, it was just to help. It was to save the baby's life, but she didn't know that. Right. And I think, like, that's where the role I think doulas would do, to be a voice in that moment, so that it doesn't rely on the mom who's, like, literally going through the most difficult thing she would ever do in her life to make those decisions in those moments.
I think also what the doula does is it provides a buffer between we have a really well run, in many cases, health system with high, you know, tech equipment and all that kind of thing. But we also, having a baby is scary. Having a baby can be difficult. It can go wrong. And so to have an advocate there, mm-hmm. I was really impressed with the Birthmark Doula Collective in New Orleans, because Simone Landrum's doula, Latona Giwa, had been a labor and delivery nurse. And so she had all of that knowledge, plus she had the care. And at one point, we were all looking at the heart rate monitor. 100% of us, except for Latona, who was looking at the mom. Mm-hmm. She was hyper-focused on the mom. And I just thought that's a symbol for what is happening here.
Wow.
Linda, in all your reporting, what is one thing you think that is so obvious that could help correct this problem?
I think the most obvious thing is to pay attention to what people are saying. So I went to do a grand rounds at a hospital with 12 OBGYNs. It was a large hospital in the Midwest, and they argued every single point. And I had already proven it all wrong in, you know, it's like, oh, it's a lack of education. And they were blaming their patients. They were talking about how African women have different kinds of culture, African women immigrants that make everything better that African Americans don't have. I'm like, help, what? This is wrong. So I just thought, these people, 12 white doctors, need to get educated on this. And then, so I'm thinking already about those medical students who will do a better job, who will go in, who want to do a better job, and thinking, that's why I love that doctors will be different in the future. I think the other thing is really about doulas. Doulas, midwives cannot solve this problem, but can at least bridge a gap. So we need to pay them better. We need to have them get organized. We need to acknowledge them and thank them for their work. And what I find sad about this is Black people may be just, Black mothers and babies may be just the canaries in the coal mine. Mm. So if discrimination really is the problem, it shows up through race. All kinds of discrimination harms people, whether it's Islamophobia, whether it's homophobia, whatever it is, it's anti-immigrant, it's hatred for the poor. This shows up in people's bodies. And this is what is sort of the newer thinking, is to look, we have to confront discrimination both in our society and in our healthcare system, not just for Black people, but for us, but for everyone.
My guests have been Verilyn Williams from WNYC. You should go listen to her episode, Giving Birth Why Black. It's part of the Stakes podcast hosted by Kai Wright, and Linda Villarosa. Thank you so much for sharing your reporting, Linda, and thanks for coming in and sharing your stories.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is All of It on WNYC.